This is Fresh Air. The journalist Gad Gross died March 29th, covering the aftermath of the war in the Gulf. My guest Frank Smyth heard the shots that killed him. Smyth, Gross, and several other journalists entered Iraq illegally at the end of the war to cover the Kurdish rebellion. Smyth is a freelancer who was on assignment for The Village Voice, CBS News Radio, and The Economist. Gad Gross was a 27-year-old German photographer on assignment for Newsweek. The Kurdish uprising was at its peak when they arrived in northern Iraq. When the rebellion was put down by Iraqi soldiers, the journalists literally ran for their lives. Smyth says Gad Gross hid in a house with the Kurd who had been their guide. Both were killed. Smyth hid in a ditch with French photographer Alan Bou. They were taken prisoner by Iraqi soldiers and held for 17 days. We invited Smyth to tell us the story of his captivity and the murder of his friend. Smyth says the thought he might be captured never crossed his mind because he was confident the Iraqi army was broken and the Kurdish rebellion would succeed.
We entered with the Kurds and we traveled almost 200 miles south with them over a period of 9 days. We saw no sign whatsoever of the Iraqi army, with the exception of some Iraqi soldiers who were walking freely in the city of Arbil, having already surrendered to the Kurds. They controlled the entire area of northern Iraq and Kurdistan, and certainly the only sign of resistance we saw was a helicopter firing on one day near Mosul until we got to the southern limit of the rebellion, which was Kirkuk. But certainly the north, Saddam's regularly deployed army had completely collapsed, and the Kurds were in complete control of the situation. In fact, the question wasn't whether or not the Kurds would succeed, but how much time Saddam had left.
When did you start to feel the situation turn?
Well, when we got to Kirkuk, we were on the front line, and it seemed at least there that there was something left of Saddam's army. 2 miles outside the city, the paratroopers had set up a line of defense along with tanks, and they appeared to be holding their own. They weren't attacking the Kurds, but were holding their own. My impression at the time was that these units had been ordered there by Saddam Hussein, but they didn't have the morale to actually go out and attack, because the Kurds, while we were there, were engaging these forces from a distance, and certainly the Kurds controlled the city, and Saddam at that time seemed like he still had some troops left, but was relatively weak. Of course, that was a terrible mistake. In fact, Saddam was merely biding his time to launch a major counteroffensive. That took place on the morning of March 28th. It wasn't until the 28th, we were captured the following morning. It wasn't until the 28th that the tide really began to turn and the counteroffensive began. Of course, then they rolled through Kirkuk and retook the rest of Kurdistan, Saddam's army, within a matter of 4 days.
Now, you were surprised to find out that the Kurds had no idea how to use a lot of the weapons that they had captured. Is that unusual for a rebel group?
Well, the problem with the Kurds is that they weren't a rebel group with a lot of experience. The Kurds had fought for decades against the Turks as well as inside Iraq and in Iran. But this rebellion began March 14th at the end of the Gulf War. And 9 out of 10 Kurdish men who were armed had never previously carried a gun, had no experience. So the problem was you had a lot of very eager people armed with light AK-47 assault rifles as well as rocket-propelled grenades. But they simply didn't know how to use the tanks, the anti-aircraft guns, and other heavy artillery that they'd captured from the Iraqi army. Also, there was an organizational problem. You had groups of hundreds of Kurdish rebels waiting for orders, but they weren't deployed in a guerrilla sense. There wasn't really a command structure of competent leaders, at least not enough of them, to really handle this great influx of men, which really increased tenfold in a matter of weeks.
Were the Kurds looking out for you?
Yes, very much so. We had a guide with us, Batyar, who was killed along with Gad. They very much were concerned for our safety and our well-being. At the same time, they recognized that we wanted to be at the front and we wanted to cover the story. Of course, at the time, if the front was going to move anywhere, they thought it would be further south. No one expected that Kirkuk would be retaken so easily by the Iraqi army and then the rest of Kurdistan.
When did you realize that it was time for you to run for your lives?
Well, the morning of the 28th, we were sleeping in a oil refinery building, and Kurdish commanders came in and said, look, it's time to go. The shelling was very heavy and was coming closer to where we were sleeping than it had come over the past 3 days. We went to the downtown area, and that seemed relatively quiet. But over the course of 2 hours, the shelling increased there. We went out with some Kurdish rebels towards the southern edge of the city who were going to engage some Iraqi tanks. And then it became very clear that these people didn't know what they were doing. They didn't have the experience. They would go on top of a house, for instance, and set up counterberry fire against the tanks. And within a matter of minutes, I watched literally as a shell just ripped the house to shreds. By that point, we knew we had to get out of the city. We were hoping to be able to go back downtown and retrieve our packs. It didn't take long before we realized that we'd have to abandon the packs and try to get them at a later date. The problem was, when we finally did go out of the city, the Kurds said, look, just get a car and we'll drive north, and soon you'll be back in Arbil and you'll be out of danger. What they didn't know is the Iraqi army had set up an ambush, and rather than attacking from the west and the south in the city, had circled around to the north and was in the process of cutting the road to Arbil. So we literally drove north directly into an ambush at a time when the Kurds said that, or they thought, that the army was only in the south and west of the city.
My guest is journalist Frank Smythe. While covering the Kurdish rebellion, he was taken hostage by Iraqi soldiers. His colleague, photographer Gad Gross, was killed. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is freelance reporter Frank Smythe. He and photographer Gad Gross covered the Kurdish rebellion in northern Iraq following the Gulf War. When you fled from the Iraqi army, you ended up separated from Gad Gross. Can you tell the story of where you ended up and how that happened?
We were driving north. We were going to try to make it all the way through to Arbil, but it became very clear as we came up over this pass that we were driving into literally a wall of fire. To the left of us, there was a pickup truck that had crashed. The driver was slumped over the wheel. He had been shot. There was a bus that had taken a hit from a shell that was completely demolished. Body pieces were strewn about the road, and there was machine gun fire coming over in a very steady stream across the road itself. So we abandoned the vehicle and wound up behind a house. Our driver was someone we were hitchhiking with. He drove further into the terrain by mistake. We wound up trapped behind this house with bullets literally flying all around us, thousands of them. And at the same time, the Iraqi army was using Kikucha rockets, which is a flatbed truck that fires up to 40 missiles in succession. They were landing on fields behind us, making it almost impossible to run. We had seen a column of tanks descend from a mountain pass about 200 or 300 yards away, but now we turned and there were two tanks coming right at us about 50, little more than 50 yards from us, coming right in our direction. Gad and Bahtiyar, our Kurdish guide, started to run first, and they veered behind a house. Alan and I were slightly behind them. We looked over our shoulder and we thought we saw the tank turret turning in our direction. We could see the tank clearly. We thought the tank had seen us. We thought there was going to be a shell coming in at any moment. Gad and Bahtiyar veered right behind the house. We saw a ditch a little bit to the left and we just dove right in it. We then wound up staying in the ditch for 18 hours and we never saw Gad or Bahtiyar again.
How did you know that Gad Gross was killed?
We were hiding in the ditch. We had spent the night in the ditch. The last we had seen Gad and Bahtiyar was between 2 and 3 in the afternoon the day before. We weren't sure if they had were able to run away or to steal away in the night. They were further from the road, further from the tanks than we were. We thought maybe they might have had a chance. But in the morning, the soldiers were all around us throughout the night. Very close. We could hear them walking. We could hear them talking. We could hear them opening cans of food. They were all around our position as well as around the house where we had last seen Gad and Bahtiyar. In the morning, we heard a soldier near the house, and all of a sudden this tremendous amount of commotion. and banging as if they were banging against metal desks or something, and it was clear that they had discovered something or someone in the house. The soldiers started yelling, a lot of commotion, a lot of anger. Many other soldiers came running over until there must have been, you know, at least 10 soldiers gathered at this house. They then started going through and just banging around the rest of the house, and it was clear that now they were searching the rest of the house, is what I thought at the time. And then we got, you know, more commotion and more anger, and it was clear that they had discovered someone else. It all took place, you know, in a matter of minutes, and it's Alan and I compared notes. We pretty much recall it in the same way, but it's very difficult to remember everything. But we know it was a matter of maybe 3 or 4 minutes that the whole incident took place. After the banging, I believe I heard a soldiers yelling, and it was clear that they were yelling at the people they had captured. I thought I heard a soldier yell, "Kurdi." We then, after that, and there were some shots fired, we then heard a very loud, very strong, very powerful scream, which Alan and I both believe was certainly Gad. And it's not clear, I believe he was screaming because Bat Diar had either already been killed or they were about to kill him. It was just a very strong scream of defiance. I don't think it was necessarily a scream of pain. And then there was a 5-second delay and then another long burst of machine gun fire. The commotion died down, the situation, the soldiers stopped yelling, and then the situation returned to calm. An hour later, or actually, I'm sorry, about 10 minutes later, Alan peeked over the edge of the ditch and saw a soldier carrying Gad's camera bag away from the house, so we knew that they had been involved in the incident. And then an hour later, a soldier was walking near the ditch where we were in. He glanced down. He saw us. Alan fortunately saw him. He jumped up and yelled, you know, "We're journalists." And later on, we saw Gad's camera bag. We saw identity papers with blood on it. And also, soldiers told us, two officers told us, that he had killed himself because he had a gun.
You don't believe that? You don't believe he killed himself?
No, I don't believe that for a minute. Gad and I had discussed the concept of self-defense in a war zone, and Gad was adamant that a reporter under no circumstances should ever carry a weapon.
Why not?
Just because it compromises you, it compromises the profession, it's not your role. And certainly it probably would in the long term decrease rather than enhance your own security.
What went through your mind when you heard him shot?
Well, it was just, you know, it was really shock. You know, we were hiding in this ditch. We had been there the whole night. Soldiers are walking all around us. When we heard that, we realized that people had been discovered, I was hoping, well, maybe it's not them. And then once we heard the scream and heard the shots, we realized that it probably was them. And it was just a terrible feeling of shock and also some denial. When I was captured and we were brought to a gathering place where there were some other prisoners, I knew that Bat Diar was dead, but I was hoping to maybe see Gad, you know, maybe he'd been hit or something but was still alive. And then, of course, I was searching the area, hoping to come across him, and then my eyes sort of just fell upon his camera bag, and I knew then that that he was dead.
Did you think that you were going to be killed, too?
Absolutely. When we were captured, a soldier came up to me, and we were at gunpoint. We were told to put our hands higher. He searched my jacket. I couldn't get the zipper was stuck. It wasn't actually my jacket. It was Gad's. When I couldn't get it off, he pulled out a grenade and made like he was going to stick it inside the jacket. Another soldier, as we were walking out, we were, you know, petrified. Some of them spoke English. We were saying, "Please, we're journalists. Don't kill us." We said, "Where are we going?" When they said, "Okay, come with us," because we were afraid we would be taken somewhere and executed. And a soldier looked at us and laughed. He understood what I said. And he said, "You..." And he drew his finger across his neck. About 10 minutes later, we were brought to see the captain, as he was described. He spoke English as well as another officer present. When we got there, the captain looked at us and he said, "I want to take the gun and shoot you." He was very angry. We pleaded for our lives. There was a paratrooper officer who kept telling us, I kept saying, "Look, we're sorry, we're just journalists." He said, "Are you married?" I said, "You know, I lied." And I said, "Yes, I have a wife and three kids." And he said, "I'm sorry, it's too late for you." So certainly, we thought we were going to be killed. Also, there was another officer present at the time we were captured, who I believe was a military liaison from the ruling Ba'ath Party. He kept reassuring us, "No shoot, no shoot." At the same time, other officers were saying they were going to kill us, or other soldiers were saying they were going to kill us. And this officer later had a discussion, or an argument, I would say, with the paratrooper officer, in which I don't speak Arabic, but it was clear from the body language. The one officer was sort of making a case, and he was, you know, his body language was very opening, and he was clearly making some sort of point. And the other paratrooper officer was shaking his head. He pointed to Gad's identity card and then pretended to write on his hand and said the word Sahafi. So it was clear that he was saying, you know, "Gad, this guy was executed. These guys are friends of his. They're journalists. They're going to write about it. And for that reason, we have to kill them." I think there was a genuine debate over what to do with us. Since there was a division, the officer in charge could make the decision by himself. So it had to be relayed to higher authorities. And fortunately, officers in the Iraqi army seem to be quite fearful of taking making decisions on their own where there might be repercussions. For that reason, as we understand, our case was eventually referred directly to Saddam Hussein, who made the decision himself.
Journalist Frank Smythe. On our next show, he'll tell us more about his captivity and release. This is Fresh Air.